And that was Philip King, the spirit who presides over the Other Voices Festival. We're sitting here in Dingling, County Kerry, and the wind is howling outside. Last night bore witness to the first night of the festival, which concluded with a performance from The Frames and Glenn Hansard. And towards the end, Glenn recited a piece of a poem by Seamus Heaney. And I wanted to ask Philip, who is the figure who brings this all together, as well as being a musician, about that poem. We were discussing it earlier when we stood out on the west coast, the westernmost point of Europe. Tell me about that poem, Philip, and how it relates to music in this part of the world.
Well, the poem was written by Seamus Heaney, and he was a regular visitor to this part of the world in the late 50s and in the early 60s. And he used to come here with Sean O'Riordan, whose son played last night, Pather O'Riordan. And Sean O'Riordan was one of the founding fathers, I suppose, of what we would call the modern movement in Irish traditional music. And Heaney, when he came here, was struck, of course, by the language and by the music of this place. And the story goes that he heard a tune with the Irish title Pórt na Buachaí. A puka is the Irish word for a ghost or a spirit. And I suppose Pórt na Buachaí, literally translated, would mean spirit music. Music that is informed by, I suppose, you know, wind and sea. And the story goes that he went into a room and he heard this tune being played, and was asked, or he asked the question, you know, where did that tune come from? And the guy who was playing it on an old accordion said, well, this isn't our tune. We got this tune when we were out on the water, the Blasket Sand, that body of water between Dunquin and the great Blasket Island. And the tune was given up by the sea, so to speak. So there are elemental things here, wind and the sea and the movement of the water. And Heaney wrote a poem in response to that story called The Given Note. And it is about the music that is given, the music that is not owned by any one person, is not entailed or a piece of intellectual property, but rather a thing that is shared by everybody. And that's how the story goes. And I think Glenn quoted the poem last night from the most westerly Blasket. From a dry stone hut, he took this air out of the night. And it goes on to talk about, so whether he calls it spirit music or not, I don't care. It's, you know, comes off out of mid-Atlantic. The beautiful line in the poem where he says, notes coming in on loud weather. And there's certainly loud weather outside the window as we're sitting here chatting away.
It is the most westerly point of Europe. And tell me about how people from this part of the world left and went to America, and how that informed the music in America, and then how it came back here.
Well, that's a big, long story, really. You know, the first emigrations out of Ireland to America were probably in the 1700s, you know, out of Ulster mainly, down through the Cumberland Gap and down to that part of the world. And certainly the music that those people would have brought with them would have been part of them, I suppose, the music that informed what ultimately became, I suppose, you know, American Appalachian bluegrass type of music. You can hear elements of Scots Irish music there. The emigrations from this part of the world probably were post-famine into the beginnings of the last century, and then continuing through the last century. And the Blasket Islands were left by 1952, there was nobody. In 1953, there was nobody living on the Blasket Islands, and many of those islanders would have gone to Boston and to Springfield, Massachusetts, and would have, you know, gone to live there en masse almost. But we brought many things to America, but we brought the music in particular in our heads, in our hands, and in our feet. We brought tunes and we brought songs, and you know, it's my contention anyway that we've left an indelible thumbprint on the way in which, you know, American music developed. You know, we could talk about Stephen Foster, we could talk about minstrelry, we could talk about George M. Cohan and Broadway, the beginnings of music hall in America, you know, that sort of thing. And then, you know, on in the Irish and the Jews, you know, in Tin Pan Alley, there are many, many you know, songs and stories that come out of that. So, you know, that, and then Irish traditional music in America, something happened to it, because when it left here, It collided with technology in America, and it was recorded for the first time. When the music was played in Ireland, it was played in situations like you and I are having this conversation. I would play a song for you, or I'd play a tune with you, and that would be the end of it, because there was no recording. There were no ways of, you know, noting it down electronically. But when the music went to America, it found itself in the cities of Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, in a huge sort of way, New York, etc. Loud places, noisy places, places, you know, the Industrial Revolution. These were big, big cities. And the music would have left places like this, you know, rural places, quiet places. So the music automatically changed in America because the context changed. So people played it in a different way. They played it in different keys. They played it louder. They probably played it faster. They played it in big dance halls and brawling sorts of bars. One of the great Irish fiddle players, Paddy Killoran, used to play in a pub over there called the Tub of Blood. And I'd say the Saturday nights there were fairly good. But the most significant thing that happened to Irish music in America was that it met recording. So whether it was wax cylinders or 78 records, the music was recorded. And once it was recorded, I suppose it changed forever. Because before that, every performance of Irish music was a unique performance. It could never be replicated exactly. But once the recording, it's obvious to say once the recording thing had happened, it was there forever. Even when the musician was dead, you could put on the record and it would play. But significantly, those records were sent back to Ireland. And we put them on here and we listened to them and we copied what came from America, because what came from America was good. It often had a check attached or some dollars or whatever. So when we copied that music, and so you could actually say as well that the American experience informs the way in which Irish traditional music is played today because of those recordings.
Is there also an element to which one of the other big things that happened is that it met a tradition coming from West Africa, and it met rhythm and blues. So this is going back earlier to those first waves of immigration and going into the Appalachians, and it's a pretty crude description of it, but in a sense that becomes country music, and it's country music then meeting a black African tradition which gives birth to rock and roll.
I think there is no doubt about that. I think that's absolutely true. I think, you know, the coagulation of these things together made rock and roll. I mean, when you sit down with the Everly Brothers, and I did about 20 years ago in Jack Clement's house in Nashville, and they sat down, they walked into the room, and it was just, it's an amazing day. Here were, you know, people who were, I suppose, just so influential and so much a part of when we think of, you know, the Louvins, the Everlys. It's not a huge step to end up with the Beatles, you know, like hearing those beautiful close harmony things. So the Irish thing is there as well. They sang a song called Down in the Willow Garden. It's absolutely beautiful. And of course, it was on that record, Songs Our Daddy Taught Us. And, you know, you can trace that song right back to here. And going to the States. But of course, they were white, and they were living in that part of the world, and they were absorbing black music as well. And you can hear that in some of the things that they were about. I mentioned Chicago, you know, the music that went up the Mississippi all the way to Chicago. And again, the country blues met technology and became a sort of a Chicago loud, clanky, noisy, sort of beautiful music. And, you know, without that, there isn't any Rolling Stones, I guess.
You know. Do you have an impression some of the artists who've come here and come to this part of the world, particularly from America, do you get a sense that they rediscover something or find something they didn't understand fully themselves, that there is a tradition here which they only just realised existed once they arrived in this place?
I think that's true. The musicians that have come from the States to here have a sense of reconnection in some way. At least they tell me so. And their antennae are very honed. They sense something. And they sense something in this place. They sense a musicality in the place that is part of the way in which people speak, the way people still speak the language here. There's a cadence and a musicality in it that's very alluring for artists and guitar players and singers, because it's musical in itself. So they hear that thing and they relate to that. And then I suppose there's the more abstract thing. you know. They sense the music here. They hear people playing, you know, accordions and fiddles. And I remember Ricky Skaggs saying to me, you know, I said to him, you know, what is that high lonesome sound in Kentucky? I asked him one time, and he said, that's the music remembering where it came from, is that sort of that call of that thing. So when, you know, when Rufus Wainwright is here, or Martha is here, or the boys from the National are here, you know, these are guys from Ohio living in Brooklyn, in a very, I suppose, a cool sort of part of New York and sort of the heart of a scene in New York. But when they arrived here, it was almost instant. They'd never been here before, but they related to the place in a completely natural sort of way, almost automatically. And I can only put that down to the fact that they're artists and they do sense something here. And I think that's why people come here. There's a sheer physical beauty here as well that's very powerful. When the wind and the light are beautiful here, it's a very powerful place and a very inspirational place. The Snow Patrol people lived here for some time and wrote a lot of their songs just about 8 miles from where we're sitting now, just out what we would call the edge of the Dingle Peninsula. And, you know, people come here. Glenn talked about that last night, about the Frames coming here, you know, to write and to play their music. It seems to me that it might be a safe place for music.
You talked about how the biggest thing that happened to Irish music was it being captured by technology and translated onto records. But is there a sort of wider sense in which something was lost at that same point as well? I mean, sitting in the church last night and hearing Truer playing, and it is a feeling of the music living and breathing and being a live thing, and it's not a replica of something on a music. It lives in the moment.
Yeah, I think music does live in the moment, and I think those performances and the performances that happen here they're unique performances. And what we tried to do, I suppose, really, is never to be prescriptive, never to tell anybody what to play. The church is the context. People walk in and they play their music there. It is an orally transmitted music for that moment. It is like our conversation here. It's real, in real time. And I suppose the thing to do, really, and the thing that we try to do, is to capture that in a pure sort of way, but then to platform it in a way that people can sense it or feel it or listen to it and enjoy it.
How important is the sense of place in music? Some people say that, you know, that's one of the things that's lost, particularly in modern recordings of the last 20, 30 years, is that everything could have been, a piece of music could have been made anywhere, and in fact often is made anywhere. It's recorded in six different places around the world, and it's made on Pro Tools, and it lacks that specific sense of place of where it comes from, whether that's some indefinable feeling of what the particular studio is like and the heaviness of the air, say, at you know, Stax in the Deep South or something.
I think that's fair comment, and I think that some records are made that way. And they, as you say, it's Pro Tools, and they're sent around the world instantly. We'll drop on the vocal in Los Angeles and we'll get somebody else to mix it in London, and then we'll send it to Berlin. I sense myself that there is a hunt for authenticity in many of the artists that I meet, some of those living in Brooklyn. I think there's a sound beginning to emerge. I think the National have that sort of zeitgeist, the American sound. Certainly last year, there was a sort of a sense for me that it was a sort of a sonic wash to the times that we live in. One of the great song collectors that I got to know, a man called Frank Hart, once said to me, he said, if you want to know the facts, consult a history book. If you want to know what it felt like, ask a singer. And I think that the best music and the music that will endure is music that is born out of place and time, that has, you know, when you go back to the old jukebox in your own head and you're driving along and something comes on the radio, or you're walking in New York past a record shop and you hear something blaring out from, you know, 1971. And if for that moment you're there, you know where you were, you know what it felt like, you can smell it. The music does it for you. And the best music and the music that endures, I think, has that quality. There are some very interesting musicians in Ireland that I have conversations with who ask the question you've just asked. If I could go back to traditional music for a moment, in this part of the world, almost from parish to parish, the tunes will be played differently. You know, if I was in County Waterford in the southeast of Ireland, the landscape itself almost informs the way in which the music, the cadence of the music is. It's beautiful, it's lush, it's sort of rolling hills, and you can hear the cadence of that in the music. If I was in Connemara, which is rocky, hard and flinty, you know, the cadence of the music and the accent of the music is different. So you're absolutely right. You know, one can lose that sense of place in the new modern recording process. But I think that some of the artists that come here have heard that question and are afraid of that, really, of losing the heart and soul of the music, and will seek to go to places or to be in their own place and record out of their own place in an authentic and real way.
Mm-hmm. And the final thing I want to ask you is, it also strikes me, and I've been here a day now, but that the musicians who come here check their ego at the airport and they put that away, and it is about the music here, and it seems to me increasingly valuable to create those spaces in which they can foreground that, and it is the focus of the concentration. It's not about who they are or their personality. It is what it is.
Glenn Hansard said yesterday, talking to Aidan Gillen, he said that it's the art, not the artist, that's important. And I think there's a sense of that here. You know, the egos are checked away. There is everybody who walks into the room has a value that is the same as everybody else. And, you know, in Ireland and in this place in particular, people gather in rooms and gather themselves up. And there's that tradition of what we call the noble call. You know, I'll ask you to sing a song, and then you can call on the next person to sing a song because you've sung a song. And there's something of that here. And with Lisa Hannigan and James Vincent McMorrow and those people who are coming this evening, you know, they'd probably all sing into the night, you know, when the thing in the church is finished. And, you know, it's just a delight to have them here and to hear them raise their voices to sing.
Great. Thank you, Philip King.